Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm working from a brilliant book I've been sent by IB Taurus, World War I in Central and Eastern Europe, Politics, Conflict and Military Experience. It's a collection of essays that seeks to be part of this task that I'm really interested in rebalancing our perspectives of the First World War. An Anglocentric view of things, which inevitably a history teacher like myself has grown up with and kind of perpetuates, really, is that of the Western Front. But if you consider that not only was the Western Front only a small portion of the overall fighting in the First World War, but that a far bigger front was that between Austria, Germany, and Russia. And that because of the collapse of the Central Powers and Russia and the Ottoman Empire, violence continues within the eastern portion of Europe and the Middle East up until 1923 and even slightly beyond, due to the development, the emergence of successor states, and the fighting between those. It makes for an incredibly dramatic and detailed and fascinating part of the world that once again is plunged into violence, into enormous bloodshed from 1939 onwards as the new boundaries and new borders are once again torn up by Hitler. Those that are created at the Treaty at the Paris Peace Conference and the various treaties that emanate from that. Anyway, the thing that I'm going to look at today is a fascinating essay called The Failed Quest for Total Surveillance. And this is a discussion of how Austria-Hungary spied upon not only its own people, but also on subversion during the war. This is an essay written by historian Mark Lewis, and the interesting thing for me is the means by which the security state of the Austro-Hungarian Empire emerged. If you look at the means by which the modern British security state emerged prior to the First World War, it was based around the insecurities of empire, the fear that the British Empire was going to be undermined by Germany, by naval rivalries and the spying on naval secrets, and the building of German dreadnoughts, and these anxieties brought about MI5 and MI6. And the significance of that is that obviously the Navy was the means by which, kind of the glue by which the British Empire is held together. Now, intelligence and counterintelligence, espionage and internal security all roll into one in the case of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and even before it became the Austro-Hungarian Empire after the defeat of 1866. There was a robust and growing security culture all the way since the revolutions of 1848. The glue that held the Austro-Hungarian Empire together is obviously the state, and the state becomes under increased pressure throughout the 19th century and into the 20th from the demands of liberal and then not so liberal nationalism. And these were the forces that the intelligence and security state within the Austro-Hungarian Empire tried to stamp out, these forces that were likely to tear the empire apart. The part of the context of that, for those that aren't students of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, is a multi-ethnic land empire. So it incorporated Austrians, Hungarians, Romanians, Ruthenians, Poles, Czechs, Croats, and other nationalities under the Habsburg throne, and then later the dual monarchy after 1866. And because of this, nationalism was an existential threat to the Austro-Hungarian Empire and threatened to dissolve it from within. So by the time the First World War begins, generations of secret policemen had already been active in preventing this from happening. During the First World War, the Austrian military, and Hungarian of course, were vehemently opposed to all sources of nationalist politics. They had gone to war, really, as the result, as they saw it, of extremist nationalist politics, the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo, and nationalist politics had been nothing but a source of consternation and trouble for the empire since the 1840s. The empire had two major defeats inflicted upon them by France and by Prussia as a result of nationalist movements in Piedmont and in Germany, and it's not hard to see why nationalism as a concept was an unpleasant notion to those in the metropole in Vienna. Mark Lewis writes, Austria was a European innovator in the creation of a higher state police. A residence registration system and the implementation of enlightened social policy in which the centralising state supervised its officials and reported on the mood of the people. Johann Anton Graf von Pergen created the higher state police in the 1780s and expanded the residence registration system. During the Metternich era, Police Minister Count Sedlinski expanded the system, creating networks of confidential informers to watch secret nationalist organisation in the Habsburgs' Italian lands and partitioned Poland, as well as suppress the spread of German nationalism and republicanism by using censorship, arrests, restrictions on university enrolments and travel bans. Though some aspects of the system were dismantled after 1848-49, the Habsburg Empire, Austria's First Republic, and the Austro-fascist corporate state all maintained a central office that kept files on politically suspicious people. So, as you can see, throughout the 19th century, Austria was holding back the tide of nationalism and using state surveillance in order to do it. These traditions continued throughout the First World War and into the interwar period. But it's the First World War chiefly that we're interested in today. In about 1913, as a response to the increased pressures of Italian nationalism, the Italian state wanting the Irredenta lands along the Dalmatian coastline of Croatia. Pan-Slav nationalism, centering mainly around Serbia and Greater Serbian nationalism. The policing of nationalities transformed. The political bureau of the Vienna Police Direction began to cooperate with military intelligence, combining domestic surveillance with counter-espionage, because domestic concerns, the domestic nationalist agitation, was intimately connected with overseas powers. It was Russia that was a principal force behind Serbian nationalist and Slavic nationalist agitation in the Balkans, for example. So the two worked hand in hand. This is a development in intelligence history that you see throughout the world at different stages throughout the 20th century, that internal subversion and external espionage merge seamlessly, measures against them merge seamlessly into one. Perhaps one way of interpreting that is that it relates on some level to the history of a kind of a more integrated and globalised world, that threats to the state never remain or within the borders of the state or unconnected to threats further afield. It was fortunate for Austria that this collaboration did happen, as it began to uncover some major spy networks within Austria, particularly those that emanated from Imperial Russia, which was ahead of the game for most of the 19th century, compared to nearly every other European power in their sophisticated espionage activities. For evidence of this, everyone should read Adam Butterworth's brilliant book, The World That Never Was, about spies and anarchists across Europe in the 19th century, and the role that Russian intelligence played in all of that. In May 1914, just before the war began, the Austro-Hungarian Army's Intelligence Bureau, the Vienna Police Directorate, and the Hungarian Border Police formed a new kind of domestic counterintelligence system in order to keep an eye on suspected spies and suspicious individuals. And the main focus of their efforts was, of course, on Russian spies and espionage. And Russian espionage against Austria-Hungary had grown significantly since 1906. Provincial governments had done much of this work since 1910, encouraging police and other organs of the state to keep an eye on individuals, to watch particular installations such as bridges and military camps, and to keep the army aware of any seemingly suspicious or unexpected developments. But the central government in Vienna and Budapest were not coordinating these activities. I had to wait till 1914. And without any official measures, it was possible for those accused of or convicted of espionage to be expelled from one province and to carry on operating in another before the existence of wartime controls. Espionage was not punishable by death. A new system was established called the Defensive Kundschaftdienst, which was able to quickly communicate information between the state police and the local regions, and would also engage in spying overseas. Austria-Hungary was a dual monarchy of 60 million and divided into four administrative areas: Austria-Hungary, Bosnia, and the Kingdom of Croatia, Slavonia, and Dalmatia. You can kind of...
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
To see why it was that Franz Kafka writers talked about the bureaucratism of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The whole counter-espionage system was about creating huge amounts of data that could be shared across the entire system. And it meant, obviously, in the pre-computer days, vast amounts of paper being moved around. And it meant that there was a surveillance state in the development, which meant that not just spies were focused on, or people who were specifically known to be spies, but much of the population was suspect, and there was a kind of a sense of guilt until proven innocence. And that the people of Austro-Hungary would become a supervised civilian population. Now, this is really the response to fissile nationalism. This is the kind of the new glue that hopefully will keep the state together: constant vigilance. The First World War saw this system integrated with the people who from the postal service who censored mail and existing Austro-Hungarian police forces, which also had their own detectives and officers to investigate cases of subversion. Investigations would sometimes begin because a censor had flagged up some kind of subversive writing, and would send information through to a relevant police officer or investigator. Sometimes confidential informants would work with the police and tip off them to nationalist plots or nationalist circles. And then there would also be information from military intelligence or the public who would report suspicious neighbours. So the system actually becomes overwhelmed with a vast kind of excess, vast surplus of information, much as during Nazi Germany, the zeal and the voluntarism of denunciations actually overwhelmed the Gestapo system, so that most of the people who are informed on are rarely investigated. And the job of the Gestapo man is merely to sift the denunciations. During the First World War, political policing had fewer limitations upon it. It focused on wider groups of people, and there were fewer constitutional or legal oversights on police activity. The number of agencies and the number of bureaucratic records dramatically increased, and the number of police officers also grew. And the greater of the impacts was on the actual treatment of those who came under suspicion. The system obviously is in no way near as extreme as the Gestapo or the Stasi in the German Democratic Republic, and the Cheka as emerged in Bolshevik Russia. However, there were few methods by which one could appeal against any conviction. and a few cases in which a person who demanded release from detention was actually successful. Lawyers were rarely involved, normally due to a lack of finance or availability, but also because one would come from a social class where that really wasn't much of an option. The kinds of people who were accused of treason or sedition in poor parts of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, who had been agitating for, for example, the Irredentalands to be transferred to Italy after the First World War. Rarely were these wealthy, well-heeled individuals. This was kind of nationalism from below. Rarely did those who were engaged in nationalist activities fear the knock at the door from the secret police. They rarely encountered anything that they would recognise as a secret policeman. Normally, if they were arrested, it was by the local or state police in uniform, who would who they would recognise as people carrying out arrests for fairly standard, normal kinds of crime. Interestingly, various aspects of the Austro-Hungarian secret police system, or state surveillance system, were underfunded. The police force never became all-powerful because of a lack of finance. And much of the budget was spent, as mentioned, on the national question, disloyal nationalities such as Serbs, Croats, Czechs, Ruthenes, Galician Poles, and some Italians were the main draw for the budget of the state security apparatus. Poor police files in central offices mean that it's difficult to see exactly how many people were investigated. But historians over the years have put forward various hypotheses as to how many. It's rare, looking through the archives, to find really any or many cases of actual espionage, passing on of secret information. Things that are decried as espionage, but were often expressions of cultural national identity, speaking or writing in Czech or in Slovak or Slovene or Croat or what have you, was a way of expressing the desire for nationhood, and this itself was seditious. Austrian and Croat police, for example, investigated and interned Serbs in Slavonia who were accused of allegedly working for the Serbian secret police. They couldn't find any evidence of this claim because it basically wasn't true, and so they simply interned them anyway. And this is really kind of barely concealed prejudices at work. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that being part of a national minority in the later stages of the war made one suspect by default. For example, the Viennese police saw Czech-speaking Moravians as being Russophile or supportive of Russia. Why? Because they refused to contribute to relief efforts for wounded soldiers. Supposedly held secret meetings, though this is perhaps doubtful, and wrote graffiti on trains, which was more just a general expression of discontent about the war. In one instance, in Moravia, at the town of Prerow, or Predov, as it is known now, the Viennese police believed that Slavs in Moravia were fundamentally untrustworthy and were opposed to Austria itself. And they perhaps thought this because they saw that the Czechs and Czech nationalists had everything to gain from the downfall of the Austrian Empire. in the case of the Ruthenian national minority, in Chernivtsi, the Ruthenians from Galicia were arrested and interned. Some of these had been active in pro-Russian political parties and newspapers before the war, but the Austrian military prosecutors were unable to actually make a case against them of treason, but then continued to hold them in garrison arrest, so internment anyway. So if the actual goal of proving a legal case of treason and subversion fell down, you could still keep people in indefinite detention anyway. And what that does is it has the effect of suppressing nationalist politics and nationalist agitation, or so the authorities thought. Undoubtedly, these kinds of reactionary and brutal measures do nothing to pour oil on troubled waters. But it would prevent the opening of Ruthenian schools and generally try to disrupt Ruthenian language and culture from where it was generally believed that politics sprang from. Much of this behaviour came from the belief that the Austro-Hungarian Empire would win the war along with Germany, and that the Austro-Hungarian Empire would not break up. So one could treat ethnic minorities or national minorities with a degree of repression during the war, and at some point after the war some kind of settlement would be made and the empire would continue as is. It's only in 1918, when it appears that the writing is really on the wall for the empire, and riots in the cities and mass movements of migrants and chaos and the gradual fragmenting of the empire occurs, to be sort of concluded with the Paris Peace Conference, that the estimations of the Austro-Hungarian security state turn out to be wrong. And then it transpires that a great many of the activities, the repressive activities of the empire during the war, actually fueled the kind of fissile politics, the kind of nationalist aspirations for independence that materialised after the war with the creation of new states such as Poland, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia and Hungary, and independent Hungary, and also an enlarged Romanian state. So there is a complicated relationship between state surveillance and national aspirations, one not necessarily successfully suppressing the other. Anyway, I hope you found this useful, and I will perhaps continue with a little bit more on the Austro-Hungarian Empire during the war in the next few weeks. And if you can give us any of your attention on our Patreon page, a little bit of support is always gratefully received. We fund ourselves on donations and a tiny trickle of ad revenue. And I look forward to speaking to you soon. All the best. Bye-bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets, featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has 2 limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OSEAMalibu.com, code MOM.